Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
Good morning and happy Mother's Day. It's good to see you. If you don't know me, my name is Luke and I'm on our pastoral team. And I have the privilege of walking through the scriptures with you this morning. So if you have your Bible, you can open up to Mark chapter 6. And today we are going to be in verses 14 through 29. As you're going there, I'll just let you know where we're going to be headed as a community over the next few months in our teaching. In May and in June, we're going to continue in the book of Mark. We've been in Mark since September, and we're going to continue and finish the book, but we are going to take a break in July and in August, and we're going to be in our summer series, which we usually do, and we're going to be announcing that in the next few weeks. But for May and June, we're going to continue on in the book of Mark, which we're really really enjoying. So if you've found Mark 6, verses 14 through 29, you might see at the top of the passage a description of the story that follows. Sometimes people put that in our Bibles for us to help us see how we find different stories. And the description might be something like the death of John the Baptist or the beheading of John the Baptist. And as you're reading that description, you might think to yourself, is this the best story for Mother's Day? And my answer to that is no. It's not. It has very little to do with Mother's Day, except for the fact that it does have a mother in it, though she's not a particularly nice mother. And it does have a gift for the mother in it, though it's not a very conventional Mother's Day gift. And if you've read the story, you know where we're going. So if not, we'll figure it out. So the story doesn't have a lot to do with Mother's Day, but it does have quite a bit to do with what it means to follow Jesus and walk in truth with God. And so we're going to see some cool things come out of that this morning, I think. And who knows, there might be some Mother's Day application. Let's see where the Spirit leads us with that. Last week, Rick brought us back to our main question in Mark, which is a really important question, which is, who is Jesus? That's what Mark wants us to understand. Who is Jesus? Wants to ask us that question. And so we walked through the story of Jesus' rejection in Nazareth and the sending of the 12 disciples. Jesus' rejection in Nazareth was because he was too ordinary for them. He was too normal. He was too average looking. And so a lesson for us from that is, do we need to look impressive as Christians? Do we need to look flashy? Do we have to have it all together? Not necessarily. Jesus comes, he incarnates, he lives amongst us, and he actually gets missed by some people because he doesn't look super impressive. He's doing impressive things, but Mark tells us that he can't do those things in his hometown because people are rejecting him. And so, interesting kind of application coming out of that. And then we looked at the sending of the 12, and we learned from that that as we go, as Jesus sends us, as he sends his 12 disciples in that story, we look like Jesus. We live like Jesus. We don't sort of speak the truth to people from afar, but we are very much ingrained in their lives, and we travel light. We don't carry a lot of burdens. We stay agile, and we do our best to sort of live as Jesus did amongst people and not being weighed down by too much stuff, which has some interesting applications for us as North Americans, I think. So, as we looked at these two stories, we sort of asked that question again, who is Jesus? And that led us to another question, I think, which is not only who is Jesus, but what are we going to do with him? Who is Jesus and what are we going to do with him? And I think the story that we're in today has remnants of that sentiment, and we're going to discover that as we walk through. So, Mark 6, verse 14 says this, Herod Antipas, the king, soon heard about Jesus because everyone was talking about him. And some were saying, this must be John the Baptist raised from the dead. That is why he can do such miracles. Others said, he is the prophet Elijah. And still others said, he is a prophet like the other great prophets of the past. So in this passage, we have yet again the question of Jesus' identity. Who is Jesus? And there's varying perspectives on him. Some people think he's John the Baptist, and we are introduced to John the Baptist earlier on at the beginning of Mark. We don't know a lot about him, but we know that he comes heralding what God is going to do in the world, and he dresses in some funny clothing and eats some funny things, but he's a prophet. And as we're going to learn in this story, John has actually died. And so some people think that Jesus is actually John raised from the dead, and that's why he can do miracles. Because after all, if someone can work miracles, they must have some kind of special power, and maybe that came from being resurrected. That's the thinking in the Jewish mind at the time. So some people think that Jesus is John. Some people think that Jesus might be Elijah, because in the Jewish thinking at the time, they believe that there would be Elijah or an Elijah figure who would come ahead and say that God is going to do something amazing and restorative and liberate the people of Israel, something to that effect. And they think that maybe Jesus is this figure. Maybe Jesus is Elijah coming, announcing God's future plan. And still other people think that maybe Jesus is just a prophet, like the prophets of the Old Testament, and that's why he speaks with truth and wisdom. And that's why he can also do miracles, because that's what prophets would do. They would speak the truth, but they also demonstrate it by how they actually lived and what they could do. They could prove sort of their words. And we see Jesus again in Mark, proving his words. In reality, these perspectives are wrong of Jesus, because in actuality, John the Baptist has already come, and he is the Elijah figure. And he's coming announcing Jesus, who is not God's future plan, but God's present plan. So Jesus is already here. He's the plan, and John is the Elijah figure announcing him. It's interesting, as we look through some of the perspectives and consider something as simple as misunderstanding, that we see John is misunderstood, Jesus is misunderstood, and later on, as we move throughout the narrative of the New Testament, we see that many of the first Christians are misunderstood, people like Paul. There's a great example in Acts 21, when Paul's preaching in Jerusalem in the temple, and people get upset with him because of some of the things he's saying, and they grab him and they start to beat on him, which seems to happen a lot for Paul. And then some Roman guards come and kind of rescue Paul and pull him away from the crowds, and the head of the guard says, "Aren't you the Egyptian who led a rebellion with 4,000 people up in the hills?" Paul's like, "No, that's not who I am at all." So we see again and again and again in the New Testament flow where there is a misunderstanding. And so again, this points us back in Mark to the parable of the soils, where Jesus says, be careful how you hear. Be careful how you hear. There can be a misunderstanding of what God is actually doing in the world. Be aware of what God is actually doing. Have the right eyes to see. Have the right eyes to hear. I think this also has special application for us as followers of Jesus today, because we still, like John, like Jesus, like Paul, can be misunderstood. People can have incorrect perceptions of us or our motives or even really who we are or what we're really about. And one of the questions we can ask ourselves are we going to be controlled by public perception? Are we going to be controlled by the misunderstandings that people might have of us? Are we going to be concerned about that? What are we going to be motivated by? Are we going to walk in the truth that God has called us to, or are we going to be swayed by public opinion on certain things? And I find that an interesting application for us. So we have this kind of trying to figure out who Jesus is, some misunderstanding there. Enter into our next part of the passage here. Chapter 6, verse 16 says this. When Herod heard about Jesus, he said, "John, the man I beheaded, has come back from the dead." For Herod had sent soldiers to arrest and imprison John as a favor to Herodias. She had been his brother Philip's wife, but Herod had married her. John had been telling Herod, "It is against God's law for you to marry your brother's wife." So Herodias bore a grudge against John and wanted to kill him. But without Herod's approval, she was powerless, for Herod respected John, and knowing that he was a good and holy man, he protected him. Herod was greatly disturbed whenever he talked with John, but even so, he liked to listen to him. So we have this figure of Herod, who we're going to get into in a second, and he kind of buys into that first perspective of Jesus, that John is dead, and maybe this is John coming back to haunt him, essentially, is Herod's thinking. Now, this was an interesting little chunk of text, and there's kind of a lot going on here, so I'd love to take some time to sort of sort out what is going on. So let's talk about the family that is named Herod. Now, if you were going to select a family from the first century who would be great candidates for a reality television show, it would be the Herod family, okay? I'm not a scholar, but I've done some reading on some of the ancient families, especially like the Caesars and what's going on in Rome, and they're a little interesting, but nobody comes close to the Herods. So let me just give you a kind of a sense of what exactly is going on here. We have a man named Herod the Great, okay? Herod the Great was the ruler of Judea, sort of a rather big area where, at the time, Jesus and the first Christians would have lived. So Herod the Great is a king, but he's not really a king. His family had some power, and so he was allowed to hold that. But when the Romans came in and took over Judea, they basically set him up like a puppet king. So ultimately, Caesar has the power. Herod's kind of underneath them, and he's allowed to do some things. He's not a real king in that respect. Herod the Great is the one whom, when Jesus is born, he sends soldiers to kill all of the boys under the age of 2 in Bethlehem, okay? He is psychotic. He is just constantly concerned about power and politics and maintaining as much power as possible. When Herod the Great dies, his power is distributed throughout his sons, which is sort of normal. His kingdom kind of gets broken up. And so what the interesting thing about Herod the Great is he doesn't just have one wife, he has 5 wives, okay? So that's very normal in the ancient world, especially if you're a king, have as many wives as you want. So basically, he's got 5 wives, he's got multiple kids, and these are just some of the kids, but they're going to give us a sense of what's going on in the story. His second wife, Mariamne, or Miriam, the first one, are you with me so far? Okay. Herod the Great and her have 2 kids, Aristobulus and Alexander, who Herod kills. He's not a very good dad. He's concerned that they're going to try and take his power, okay, take the throne. So he kills them, but before Aristobulus dies, he has a number of kids, one of which is Herodias, we find in the story. Are you still with me? Okay. Mariamne, 2, Herod's third wife, okay? She has a son named Philip. Herodias marries Philip, okay? So kind of like a step-niece situation, very normal. It's about power consolidation in the ancient world. The 2 of them have a daughter whom they also name Herodias because they want to confuse us as much as possible in the 21st century. She's also known as Salome, okay? And so that's an easier way to remember it. So Herodias and Philip have Salome. Herodias doesn't want to be married to Philip anymore, so she leaves Philip, and she goes and marries Herod's 4th wife's son, Herod Antipas of Galilee. And he is ruling the Galilean region at the time. This is where Jesus lives. This is where John lives. So what we have now is Herodias living with Herod. Salome, the daughter of Philip and Herodias, are living all in Herod's palace. And that's the situation going on sort of in the story. Herodias and Antipas union is a problem for John. Because John is a prophet. And he has come to speak God's truth and to call people to repentance. And he does that for everybody. He does that for the common person, but he also does that for the monarchy. And so John is speaking the truth to Herod, and he's saying that what you're doing is wrong, because John is a prophet, and he knows the Jewish Torah, and the Torah says that you can't marry your brother's wife if your brother's still alive. That's in the Torah. And John is speaking that very, very clearly into Herod's life. Antipas has a trouble with John. Because obviously John's very special. He's a prophet. He's dressed funny. He's got a compelling way that he's speaking. People are flocking to him. And so Herod, the text tells us, likes to listen to John, but he's also deeply disturbed by him, which is interesting. Can we be confronted by the truth and be compelled by it, be drawn to it, be almost shaped by it, but simultaneously be disturbed by it? Why is that for Herod? That's the way for Herod because he knows that if he is to respond to the truth, that's going to change his situation. That's going to change his world. That's going to mix it up. So he's drawn to this truth. He's drawn to this person of John, likes listening to him, but he's also deeply disturbed by him. Have you ever felt that way before? I certainly have. So Herod Antipas comes up with this really great diplomatic situation. He imprisons John. He imprisons John. He doesn't kill John, he just imprisons him. His wife Herodias, as we read in the text, hates John. She hates that he's saying you guys shouldn't be married. She's got a real problem with that. So the situation is, and the problem that Herod solves is, I'm going to imprison John, and that's okay for John because he's not dead. And it's not great for Herodias because she wants him dead, but at least John's in prison, and that works for me. So it's a real sort of diplomatic compromise. The trouble with this in Herod's life is that diplomacy and manipulation and people-pleasing doesn't really work when it comes to God and his truth. It doesn't work. And Herod's going to find that. At the end of the day, as we're walking through Mark, we're seeing that we will be confronted by God, confronted by him in Jesus and truth, and we have to choose what we're going to do with him. We have to choose what we're going to do with the truth that God puts into our lives. And we can't manipulate it. We can't sort of find a diplomatic solution. Something's going to get shoved out of the picture. So when push comes to shove, who's going to get shoved? As we read on in the text, we see what happens. Verse 21, Herodias' chance finally came on Herod's birthday. So Herodias is the wife. She does not like John. She wants him dead. She sees her opportunity. Herodias' chance finally came on Herod's birthday. He gave a party for his high government officials, army officers, and the leading citizens of Galilee. Then his daughter, also named Herodias, this is Salome, came in and performed a dance that greatly pleased Herod and his guests. "Ask me for anything you like," the king said to the girl, "and I will give it to you." He even vowed, "I will give you whatever you ask, up to half my kingdom." She went out and she asked her mother, "What should I ask for?" Her mother told her, "Ask for the head of John the Baptist." So the girl hurried back to the king and told him, "I want the head of John the Baptist right now on a tray." So what was common in the ancient times, especially if you were powerful, was to throw a party to prove how powerful you were. So Herod does this. He invites all of his impressive friends over, and they come over to the palace, and they eat lots of food, and they probably get very, very drunk. They're having a great time, and Herod looks powerful. It's his birthday. He's got a hat on. Maybe not a hat. They've got cakes coming out. It's going on. And then this girl enters the party, and she does a dance. And scholars would probably agree that the dance is a little, not so much towards ballet or river dance, a little more towards the saucy jig kind of region, okay? There's no other way to really put it, okay? So she comes in, she's probably a teenager at this point. She does the jig, greatly, greatly pleases, as Mark tells us, all of the men who are gathered. And Herod, in this moment, trying to show off, decides to align himself with this girl in this moment. So he says, "Hey, baby, whatever you want, up to half my kingdom," which is kind of a joke because he doesn't really have a kingdom in the first place. But anyway, she shows off in this moment, and she scurries away to her mom right away. And her mom has an immediate answer, which kind of tells us that maybe your mom's got something to do with this. So there is a Mother's Day application for you. If you're a mom, don't send your daughters into parties like that. It's not a good idea. I told you there'd be something that would come out of this for Mother's Day. So the mother says, she's got an answer right away. She doesn't ask for a new chariot. She asks for a new coat. She says, "Ask for John the Baptist's head." And this is where the humor gets a little dark, because the daughter adds, when she goes back in to see Herod Antipas, she says, "Oh, I want John the Baptist's head, and put it on a plate, because after all, this is a banquet." Kind of dark humor. Happy Mother's Day. Anyway, so that's sort of a like the daughter and the mother are kind of twisting the knife into Herod, because he's caught between a rock and a hard place here. He believes John's a holy man. He believes he is speaking some kind of truth. But the family wants something different, and all of a sudden, it's like the worst birthday ever. The cake is replaced with a head. And so verse 26 says this, "Then the king deeply regretted what he had said, but because of the vows he had made in front of his guests, he couldn't refuse her. So he immediately sent an executioner to the prison to cut off John's head and bring it to him. The soldier beheaded John in the prison, brought his head on a tray, and gave it to the girl, who took it to her mother. When John's disciples heard what had happened, they came to get his body and buried him in a tomb." What I love about the Bible is it doesn't sugarcoat life. This is what happened. God's people are in the middle of this. What can we learn from it? There's a couple of observations that I think we can make from the story. The first is kind of rooted to the beginning of the story and sort of considering Herod's heart. When we're confronted with the truth, when we're confronted with God's truth in our lives, what will we do with it? Herod Antipas, like his father, Herod the Great, tries to expel the truth. Herod the Great does it, you know, in a much more pronounced way. But Antipas sort of kind of keeps it around, kind of entertains the truth for a while, tries to make it work out for everybody, the truth being embodied at this point as John. But eventually, when push comes to shove, and interestingly, the push is a drunken party with a teenage girl who does a lewd dance. That's the stuff that pushes into Herod's life. The pride, the showing off, the political agenda, and the truth in John gets pushed out. And we might look at Herod and judge him in the moment. There's been many times in my life where I choose to push the truth out over silly things. And in this moment, this is what happens for Herod, and he immediately regrets it and realizes what has happened. So what are we going to do with the truth? This is a consistent theme through all of Mark. Another observation that we have in this story that I think is interesting and probably really helpful for us is you're going to notice that John is not in the foreground of this narrative. He's actually in the background of this narrative. So he's not even the main character. We have very little about John at the beginning of Mark. The most that we have about him is actually surrounding his death. And even then, he's not actually the main character. He's not the main focus. What we learn in this is that John goes ahead of Jesus in more ways than one. He goes ahead announcing that Jesus is coming, but he also has his own passion. Jesus is going to have a passion. A lot of things are going to happen to Jesus. He's going to allow himself to be subjected to those things. And John is sort of a foreshadowing of that. He speaks the truth. He stands for justice. He stands for what is right. He calls for repentance. And he's going to receive something from the world for that. And it's a tough thing to receive. What this passage does is it points us towards remembering Jesus' sacrifice and selflessness. John is a great example of that. This is why Jesus said that he's the greatest man born of a woman, because he is willing to stand and do what God has called him to do for ultimately what will be the good of the world as he announces Jesus, as he speaks truth into his region. That occurs, and he receives a difficult situation. And this points us to Jesus, who ultimately, in humility and self-sacrifice and selflessness, chooses to do what's best for the world. And he lets himself be subjected to a very difficult experience, being the cross. What I think this can say to us, as I've been walking through it and praying through it, is to remember that God has called us as his people to action. God has called us to speak truth. God has called us to embody and live the truth where we are. And it is possible that we may be misunderstood and we may be mistreated. Now, there are a lot of Christians around the world who are experiencing some harsh mistreatment for standing for Jesus. And by comparison, it doesn't seem that we get an awful lot of that. But we still can actually struggle with it. God has called us to action. And are we going to be willing to follow him into that action with truth and love, regardless of how the world treats us? I was praying this week about this passage and thinking about it, and I really felt like there may be some of us gathered, even today, who feel that God is calling them into something very particular. Some of us, you know, when you're listening to the news and you're reading or hearing about things that go on in like Nigeria or Syria, or even more locally in like the downtown east side, or just your neighborhoods or your schools or your businesses, some of us have this like sense of just a burning sense of injustice that we just really struggle with that and feel like we need to do something to respond, that God may be pulling. And that's the spirit of God in us. But as much as we feel that pull to want to stand for justice, and we're also tempted to sort of back away from it because we're concerned about what we might give up. about what we might have to sacrifice. And the reality is that that kind of can come against some of our North American perspectives of Christianity. Because when we realize that Jesus is calling us into something that we may have to sacrifice and be selfless about, that kind of confronts the idea that God's main role in my life is to make sure I get a good parking spot at Walmart, right? Kind of comes against that. So I just felt fear wrestling today with feeling a particular call into something, and there's fear there because of what you have to give up. I just encourage you to follow the path of John, follow the path of Jesus, because ultimately Herod died and his pride died with him and he received a harsh judgment. But at the end of the day, we know that Jesus wins. We know that Jesus is doing something beautiful and restorative in this world. And whatever we are going to be subjected to by this world is going to pale in comparison to the joy that we experience when Jesus says, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter into your rest." So if you are walking through that today, I just encourage you to take heart, to look at John, to look at Jesus, to look at Paul and the other Christians and be inspired by that. Are we going to stand for the truth like John, or are we going to cower like Herod? And so I think that this kind of all points us to a reality that we see continually through Mark, which is sometimes standing for justice and truth means walking in humility and selflessness. Sometimes the thing where it looks like we're standing in truth really means humility and selflessness. And I believe that Paul understood this, which is why he wrote books like Philippians. I love when Paul writes about the attitude or the mind of Christ, because he takes this understanding that we are like Jesus, here to serve and to love the world, and it's times to sacrifice selflessly for each other. He takes that, which are these really big themes, the themes of the cross and themes of self-sacrifice and selflessness, but he takes it and he helps it apply to our lives, like our very kind of common, regular lives. And he writes this in Philippians 2, verse 3. Understanding all of this, that Jesus has come this way, that John is a precursor for it, that it's all about self-sacrifice and humility and doing what is right. And he writes this: "Don't be selfish. Don't try to impress others. Be humble, thinking of others as better than yourselves. Don't look out only for your own interests, but take an interest in others too. You must have the same attitude that Christ Jesus had. Though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. When he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on the cross. Therefore, God elevated him to the place of highest honor and gave him the name above all other names, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." Paul takes this reality of what it means to serve and to stand for justice, and he goes, it's going to mean sacrifice. It's going to mean selflessness. Don't be afraid of that, but follow Jesus' example. That is the way. And as we look back to the previous passage, when Jesus goes to Nazareth and he's rejected because he's not shiny enough for them, may we be encouraged as ordinary, regular, normal people that sometimes following and walking in the way of Jesus looks very normal, looks very humble. It looks very simple in our workplaces, in our homes, and just in our everyday lives. And so I hope that some of that connects with you today. I hope that if you are feeling called to something very particular, that you say yes to that and you follow Jesus and walk in that truth with him. But also, I hope that we can all together walk with this mind and this attitude of Christ and serve each other the way that Jesus serves us. Let me pray as we close.